Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Alison Rudd of The Times and John Cross of The Daily Mirror. Jurgen Klopp calls it a championship of will. The pace is unrelenting. The pressure can only increase. Liverpool are at the top of the league with six games to go. Is their 29-year wait for the title coming to a close? Manchester City? Well, they've still got four trophies in their sights. Will they need to win every game in the run-in? More questions than answers, aren't there?
Well, we like questions. Yeah. The big question today, I feel, amongst people who commentate and earn a living from talking about football, is whether what we've seen from Liverpool of late is a form of resilience and willpower, as you mentioned, and a sort of energy that seems to be almost by deity means heading them towards a title win, or whether what you're seeing is nervousness, self-doubt, inability to impose their superiority when it matters. And we won't, you won't know the answer to that until the end of the season. And it might yet not be in Liverpool's hands anyway. It is interesting. I think probably it's wrong to construct a narrative from the recent games Liverpool have had and come up with one theme. I think it's better to take each game in isolation. For example, at Anfield on Sunday, I felt it was a significant moment in Jurgen Klopp's tenure, actually, as a manager. He went very bold. He went almost recklessly bold. Liverpool ended up playing 4-2-4 formation. A lot of managers might have hauled off Mo Salah because he seemed to be in this strange mental vacuum where he felt it was down to him and him alone to get the winner. It didn't look like it would come. And yet his manager, who knows him better than anybody, could see that that urgency and desperation from Salah might actually reap rewards. And it did. It was an own goal, but it was created by Salah's almost hysteria, if you like. And I think for a manager in a title race that is so close to make that decision. And you can, you know, it was all too obvious how it could have gone wrong because Spurs kept breaking and really should have scored. Mm. But he had faith, I think, in his defence, Klopp, that they, you know, and we saw again what a sure defender Virgil van Dijk is. And that boldness, almost stroke recklessness, you know, paid off so that when come the end of the season, I think it's good. Come the end of the season, regardless of what happens, you know, if you're the manager of a team with that talent and that fan base, if you've not been bold throughout, or at least at crucial moments, you won't sleep well at night. I think you're more likely to sleep well knowing you did your utmost to be as brave as possible rather than being slightly negative.
Yeah, because the standards are unprecedented almost, aren't they, John? Mm. You know, I think it was Dan Storey on social media made the point yesterday that Liverpool are on course for the fourth biggest total in Premier League history, points total. Yet there's still probability as they'll finish second.
Yeah, I think it's so neck and neck. Probability, absolutely, because I guess Man City, if they win all their games, they will be champions. It's
and the squad depth is upright.
Absolutely. And listen, I like Dan a lot. And so, you know, I did sort of kind of get into a bit of a Twitter discussion about it because Miguel Delaney sort of answered him back, really, and sort of said, you know, well, actually, isn't it a form of bottling? I'm not sure that because the standards are so high, it seems incredibly harsh to compare what Liverpool's form has been like in recent times to the sort of bottling that we saw under, you know, Kevin Keegan with Newcastle, for example. There's been a couple of times when Arsenal's sort of form, even under sort of Wenger, fell off a cliff and they sort of
That's absurd, isn't it?
And really? United, and sort of Liverpool lost it in, what, in 2009 with Benitez. So it's a different sort. But we have to be realistic about this and say that when Liverpool's dip came, and City had one earlier in the season, Liverpool's dip was in the form of four draws in six games. And unfortunately, if you tally that up, that's 18 points. And so they've won two, six. And then they're basically, you know, the other four draws, 10. You've won 10 points from 18. In this pace, that unfortunately is the reason why City railed
back in. Isn't that the natural rhythm of a season?
Of course it is. Yeah. Of course it is. But City had theirs earlier in the season. But Liverpool's came when the pressure was on. And all eyes on Liverpool because this is their chance to win it. I remember going to Newcastle Man City back in January, I think it was. And Newcastle won that game. And I thought, well, blimey, that's it. It's gone. This is Liverpool's title. And Liverpool had Leicester the next day. And whether we like it or not, Leicester could have won that night, ended up with a draw. And people like me were saying, Leicester feeling the title nerves a bit. They probably were a bit, but it makes for the drama. And I'm not saying it's wrong or right, but we have to be realistic about this. If Liverpool are playing absolutely at their best with no pressure on at all, of course they win the game. But the reason why they've slipped up along the way is, to my mind, they've suffered a little bit from nerves. And Liverpool might still end up winning the title, and if they do so, they'll have won it in style and with brilliant players and with such style and with such, you know, incredible attacking prowess. But I don't think we should be wrong. I don't think we should be worried about saying that whoever loses the title from here in has shown a little less nerve than the team who will eventually be champion.
Is it nerve or is it a collection of very small minor flaws? If you take Liverpool as an example, they probably don't get enough creativity out of their midfield, so they've got to rely on the fullbacks. You know, Andy Robertson was his ninth assist on Sunday, so they're bombing on, assisting from the flanks, but they don't get the creativity perhaps they might need ultimately if they are the ultimate team from their midfield.
Well, I think it's almost the inverse of that. I think having a relatively workmanlike midfield is Klopp's way of killing the nerves, actually. He's saying, I'm going to put too much pressure on my team if they're expected everything, if everything's expected to be very beautiful and creative and just ping, ping, ping. At times and at long periods in games, we need to be able to just suffocate the opposition. We need to be able to be sensible. We need to make sensible, rather dull passes if necessary. Just make sure we read the game well and rely on the rest of the team to provide the creativity, as you say. But I do think when City have had their blips and have dropped points, that hasn't looked like nerves to me. That has looked like a very finely tuned machine just not clicking on the day, and that's not nerves, that could be tiredness, and it could be an inability to, or not really realising what the opposition were going to do, how they were going to behave, a bit of bad luck maybe, and it's like a spanner in the works. They just look like they don't quite know how to adjust their rhythm or their passion in certain matches, and it hasn't looked like a nervousness. Whereas, because we all know what to expect from Liverpool and where their goals will come from and who their stars are, if they're not doing the wonderful stuff, I think there is... People just around the club get jittery because you know what you need from Liverpool for them to win, and if it's not happening, then there is more of a nervousness to them than City when it goes wrong, I think.
Mm. Is that a nature of the atmosphere at Anfield? Because it was interesting. Mm. There was just this explosion of euphoria and relief when that goal went in.
Yeah, I think Anfield is a fabulous place to go and watch football, and I can only imagine what it's like to play. And, you know, it just must be amazing when things, the energy and the positive energy that sort of must blow the team on. It's absolutely fantastic. I mean, yesterday, you couldn't get away from the fact that I thought Liverpool were much the better team in the first half. And then after half-time, Spurs reorganised, rejigged tactically. And I thought that for much of the second half, Spurs were the better team. And then you could almost feel the kind of the nervousness and the anticipation sort of kind of coming through, really, from the Anfield crowd. And it's always been thus, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I've been there on big European nights when the crowd blows the opponents away. Absolutely fantastic. It's an amazing, irresistible energy which gives Liverpool this incredible momentum, which without doubt fires them onto fantastic and memorable victories. But at the same time, the downside is on occasion when you feel that the opposition is coming into the game, as Spurs indeed were yesterday. I thought for 10 minutes before Spurs scored, you could almost feel the goal coming. Mm. Spurs had changed the momentum and the energy in the team. And during that time, you could feel there was a nervousness, there was a tension within the ground. And that's the flip side to it. But then the energy that it gives you when Liverpool score that goal, we shouldn't underestimate, I think, how big that win yesterday was for Jurgen Klopp and Liverpool. Because if they drop 2 points and basically Man City play Wednesday night with their game in hand against Cardiff, a struggling team right now, then Man City would have been so up. And they could have gone 3 points clear, superior goal difference at this stage in time. You'd have to say it was arguably two results clear of Liverpool during the run-in. Mm. And you know, now Liverpool have basically saying, we're staying, we're not going away. And that puts an added pressure on Man City in their approach for that Cardiff game. We all expect Man City to beat Cardiff, but it won't seem quite as attractive a fixture as it would have done at 88 minutes yesterday. It just wouldn't have. And I think Liverpool have really struck a blow in this title race with that defiance. They didn't play particularly, nowhere near their best or particularly well in that second half. But to get the job done is a huge statement.
In that context, Ali, do Spurs hold the key to City's season in terms of, obviously, you've got your two Champions League games, followed, I think, on the 20th of this month by the trip to the Etihad. So are Spurs the kingmakers here?
Probably. I mean, you can make a very good case for it. It is intriguing it's intriguing enough. I think it always happens, doesn't it? When the draw's made for any cup competition, you just guarantee there'll be quite a lot of teams who are playing the same team in the league, and then 3 days later they're playing in the cup. They always clutch together. But this is really intriguing because you've got three matches close together. And you can throw in a brand new stadium, an unknown factor. Honestly, that could work. You talked about Anfield on a European night. Well, we're about to find out very quickly what the difference is between Tottenham's new stadium during the day, Tottenham's new stadium during a league game at night, and what Tottenham Stadium is like under the floodlights when it's a European game, albeit one against domestic opposition.
And in the league, they've got five of their last seven games at home.
But we don't know yet whether that equally lifts the opposition. I know there's a huge difference between West Ham moving and Spurs moving, but
one's moved to a football stadium, the other.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. And also what's happened to Spurs is a lot of clubs have come to Wembley, Spurs' temporary home, and found that to lift them. It's lifted the opposition more than the home team. Home fans didn't like going to Wembley. Stayed away in large numbers by the end. Didn't seem to give the home team any sense of entitlement or privilege to be playing there. And yet you had teams going there going, yippee, we're playing, you know, the home of football. This is amazing. And it sort of worked against Spurs. So what will happen? We just don't know. We just don't know whether Spurs will just fall in love as a team and fans with the new stadium and it become the wall of noise they're trying to create and it overwhelms the opposition, or whether it gives them a lift as well. On John and I were both at Craven Cottage on Saturday, and Pep Guardiola said, you know, we'll train at the new stadium, but it'll be their first taste of it. And then he's got to get to grips with the vibe, the lighting, the mood, the grass. Everything will be brand new for his team, but it'll be almost as new for Spurs. So it's not just that they're meeting three times very tightly close together. It's just all the other factors as well, plus what will we see City play very differently in those three games? Or will we see Spurs try and play very differently in those three games? That one of the spooky things about football, I think, is that two teams can meet in Europe, but you call it Europe and they're both English and they play completely differently. It shouldn't, but it happens. It happened with Man City and Liverpool when they faced each other in the Champions League. They were completely different teams.
Isn't that partly a knock-on because of the ridiculous nature of the away goal rule? I hate the away goal rule. But it's a nonsense, isn't it? Yeah. You've got, like, you know, two English teams, fantastic Premier League level, playing slightly different way, and they're very nervous about the away goal. Mm. They're being refereed by a foreign referee, and we're seeing sort of challenges and decisions that would probably go unpunished and sort of get away with in the Premier League. And it's a bizarre, but it makes it much more exciting, obviously, yeah, because it's just so different, yeah, isn't it? And it will, I think, honestly, the new stadium, I think, will give Spurs... It'll just be so exciting, I think, to see this new stadium. I can't, honestly, I think Spurs, and the way that they've stayed in the local area, because that is such a deprived area of North London, one of the worst areas of North London. I can say that because I don't live a million miles away from there. It's fantastic credit to that football club, and it's trying to sort of, you know, reinvigorate Tottenham.
But do you remember being a kid and it being your birthday party and everyone coming to your house, you know, your paddling pool in the garden? It was your day, but it was just too much. It just felt too much and you didn't enjoy it at all.
Well, you just retreated to your bedroom.
Just had a sulk or a tantrum, or, well, I did. Or, you know, it doesn't automatically mean you're going to enjoy it when all the pressure is on you to enjoy it.
No, and I agree with that. I don't know about your paddling pool, but what I would say is that the vast majority, even of opening games, had been very difficult for... You know, it was difficult for Arsenal in that first season. It was a difficult sort of entry into the Emirates. It was difficult for Southampton. Southampton found it difficult to find their feet. Look at Sunderland, the ups and downs, but actually the Stadium of Light it is a stadium that actually has encapsulated the atmosphere and really sort of kind of, when the atmosphere is good, it is really good. But it's a really difficult bedding in period. I think Spurs face really difficult challenges over the next few weeks in the running and also for the Champions League quarterfinal. It should be a massive occasion, but it has got this danger of being something overwhelming and inhibiting for Spurs. It's a real issue. And it was interesting to see the sort of Pochettino talk about the need to train, as you mentioned, in the ground, get used to it, because I know it sounds really obvious, but it's sight lines, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, about sort of the fullback knowing where his line is and everything like that. The margins are so fine that you absolutely have to know that ground. And the goalkeeper in particular. I mean, blimey, Hugo Lloris needs every help that he can get at the moment. But it's
true. How a bigger problem is Lloris becoming to them potentially?
Well, I'm a massive fan of Lloris, and I think some of the criticism that he's had is harsh, because I still think he's one of the world's best, and I think he's sort of kind of is the almost the perfect compromise between the sweeper keeper and a really good goalkeeper, and I think he's important to Spurs. But I think it's really interesting that a lot of the players, a lot of crucial players who are at the World Cup, I think their level has dropped, and Lloris is certainly one of those players. I think it's this kind of the mental stress and strain of being at a tournament without a break the following season. I think that Lloris isn't as bad as all that, but I think without doubt, within the next 2 years, Spurs, and arguably sooner after yesterday, Spurs will have to look towards maybe getting a new goalkeeper. But I still think that Lloris, when he's focused and in form, he's still, in my eyes, one of the best five in the world. But I just think that maybe last summer in the World Cup and everything that went with it, of course he's had problems on and off the field this season, I think has taken a mental and physical toll on Lloris. And I think that's why you've had one or two mistakes. But I really don't think... he's as bad as some of the analysis that I think sort of followed the game at Anfield. It's a catastrophic mistake. It's cost his team, of course. But I think he's saved more. I mean, look, we could re-examine it. Look at the last-minute penalty save against Arsenal. I mean, it wasn't a very good penalty, but my word, what a penalty save. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he's still a very, very good goalkeeper who's made a terrible mistake.
How important is squad depth going to be? And, you know, when we talk about squad depth, we automatically think of Manchester City. Mm-hmm. The FA Cup's next on their agenda. Brighton, I thought was very significant. You know, Chris Hughton's reaction immediately after the draw, it was, well, OK, here we go. When you look at City, how do you think they'll approach the FA Cup semi-final?
Well, Guardiola says he doesn't plot it out. He doesn't think, I've got 3 days before that game and then I'm playing in that one and then plot which players he thinks might be best suited or need a rest. He says he plays the match he's playing and then assesses it afterwards. I suspect that's not entirely true, to be honest, because you don't become a manager of that calibre without doing both. Mm. Concentrating on the next game, but also having an overarching plan of action. I mean, if they're not going to win the quadruple, then you have to assume that there will be mistakes made in the juggling. You have to assume, having such depth, and they have more depth than anybody. They have, you know, every time you go to a City game, look at the subs bench, you think, for goodness sake, although, you know, it's ridiculous. Why aren't they playing? Oh, that's why they're not playing, because the people who are playing are amazing. They have great depth. And their players are getting fit now. They're not trailing off. They're not suddenly suffering lots of injury crises. Everyone seems to be getting fit at the same
And they're
time.
Almost having, like, as you were both at Fulham, that was a training session, wasn't it?
Exactly. And you know, Neil Warnock, I hope he was joking, but he said...
Warnock never jokes.
OK. Well, he said, I might play my under-23s against Man City midweek. Well, I mean, he might be joking, he might not, but managers of opposition teams do often take the view, we cannot compete with City. So let's just think they think of the game afterwards, and they think of a game against City as giving a bit of a rest to players who might be on the cusp of needing one. But if you've got a player on the cusp of needing a rest, when do you rest him? You don't rest him in the game you think you might get a point out of if you're struggling. You rest him in the game you think you won't get a point out of. Mm. And that will help City through the season. That quite a lot of their games are training sessions, as you say, because the opposition, whether they mean to or not, are also treating it like one. They're not giving everything because they don't believe they can compete against them. But what I was going to say was the only potential downside to having such depth is that you over-juggle and you're not brave enough to stick with the same team for, say, 4 games on the trot. And you pull people in and out and it doesn't quite click. Because occasionally, as I've said, when City fail, it's because they don't click. It's not nerves, they just don't click. He's got the numbers wrong. He's put them all together in slightly the wrong places and it's just not clicking. So sometimes being blessed with so much talent, I'm clutching at straws slightly, it can be a downside because you just need to punch in the right holes in the right way. It's like a complicated computer program, really, when you've got that many good players. Mm.
So if you're Chris Hughton, John, how do you attack Manchester City? You know, where are the weaknesses? Is it going to be a set piece? Is it going to be something that Glenn Murray produces out of nothing? How are you going to make up the obvious gap in class, which is there whether, you know, we respect, you know, Brighton or not?
Well, we do respect Brighton, and I think Brighton sometimes, I think they sort of play almost within themselves and play a very sort of game not to get beaten, and I can understand why they do that. And I think that their issue will be, I think, Brighton, if you look at their results and look at their scorelines, despite their... And it is becoming a little bit precarious, although what I would say is Cardiff's defeat obviously means that they've still got a bit of a cushion there. But Brighton just do not lose heavily. They're very, very difficult, even when they lose, and their form recently hasn't been good at all. Just a very, very tight and compact. And the way that he sets up is so difficult to break down. His defensive unit is so incredibly tight and tough that their understanding between that and then the midfield protection is incredibly well-drilled. They will always create chances. I mean, even against Southampton, when they lost at the weekend, you know, they hit the woodwork. They could have got something from the game. They're very, very difficult to break down. That I think their approach will remain exactly the same against Man City, and that is trying to keep the score tight, trying to keep it down, and looking for Solly March or Anthony Knockhart to create a little bit of magic, a little bit of space, and a set piece. Because from set pieces, whether it be Lewis Dunk or, you know, earlier in the season, Duffy, they're always... And Glenn Murray still remains a prolific goal-getter for them and a threat on set pieces, much more so than running onto balls. We have to be realistic about that. But that is where their threat will come from. That if they can remain in the game in the latter part of the second half, then they will be dangerous from set pieces.
Oh, but, you know, Chris Hughton's such a lovely bloke. Mm. I mean, you know, I don't know, anyone doesn't really, really like
Absolutely,
Chris Hughton.
Yeah.
Fantastic. But that means we forget he's more than capable of creating a siege mentality, of instilling in his players a sense of not being overawed by the occasion and being brave enough to be boring for 91 minutes if necessary.
Yeah.
Which I think...
And it's also a bit
be.
Of a free hit for him, because everyone expects them to lose.
Yep.
And they haven't got that sort of overarching pressure of a Premier League game, given, you know, as you say, John, they're in a precarious position.
Yeah, and if he will look at the Carabao Cup final, where City never really sparked in that match, and Chelsea were quite clever, and they were very, very patient and frustrated City, and... You know, overall, although penalty shootout, overall, Chelsea looked like they could do it because they were tactically making City feel quite frustrated. And he will look at that and he will tell his players, don't get overexcited by being at Wembley. It's only a semi-final. Man for man, they're much better than us. But psychologically, you know, we are Brighton, and we can, if we stick to what we know and do what we know we can do well, we just might nick it. And as you say, and if we don't, so what? Mm. What he really needs is to stay in the Premier League anyway. And this is bonus football. Right? I wouldn't say to people watching it, oh, expect it to be a 6-0. I just don't think it will be.
Mm. Let's look at the other semi-final, John. Common denominators between Wolves and Watford. Highly organised, efficient coaches. Mm. Nuno and Garcia, and specialist, quite sophisticated recruitment systems, either the Pozzo model or the Mendes Chinese money model. That's the fascination for me of this tie, is you've got two of the clubs who could be the next to push on to the top six.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that Watford, I've been critical of it in the past, constantly changing the manager, and... I just don't think sometimes that provides a sort of stability and platform to work on. But I just think that they also deserve an awful lot of credit for, you know, they've had some risky managers, but it's still a massive achievement, I think, for Watford still to, you know, to almost sound patronising, to remain in the Premier League. And they've done that with, you know, the Matsaris in the past. And now they've found a really bright, progressive manager in Javi Gracia, who gets the best out of his players. I think it's interesting the way that if you look at the course of the season, whereby he's sort of kind of picked teams and players for specific games. Earlier in the season, his priority was definitely the Premier League and stability in the Premier League. So he rested completely.
Well, he was making 11 changes, wasn't
absolutely he? Picked a completely different team at Newcastle earlier in the season in the Cup. Mm. And then all of a sudden, he's done exactly the same thing in reverse at Man City, and nearly, by the way, got a result because they actually pushed City during that game. And had it not been for controversial decisions, who knows what the end outcome might have been. So I think he's a really progressive manager, and he's certainly bought into, and he's used. I thought Troy Deeney, for example, was on his way out. and it didn't fit particularly in previous regimes and under managers. He's got him fitter, he's got him more hungry, he's got him as the sort of kind of the figurehead of the team again. He's sort of kind of bought into the whole Gomez in goal, you know, sort of kind of he's picked him, he's a bit of a fairy tale through the round. By the way, will he pick him this weekend? That's the story. I'm not sure he will.
He's got to pick Foster, hasn't
Well, this it's a great debate. And I think that, you know, we will soon find out about the fairy tale of the cup, because I think you're probably right. I think he will. It felt like after that game at Vicarage Road, and everyone said, oh, that's... They're saying they're getting emotional with Gomez because it was Gomez's last game, potentially at Vicarage Road. To me, it felt as if it might be Gomez's last game, full stop.
I was at that Palace game in the last round, and you know, Gomez has always had this history of being, you know, a bit like an octopus in a blender, isn't he? He's all over the place, isn't he? And it was really interesting. At the end of that game, he was the last person to leave the pitch, and he went round and... It had the feeling of a sort of a farewell moment. I don't know. Maybe I was being a bit...
So he's let his manager off the hook then, hasn't he? By doing that, yeah. I would say.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean he's killing the fairy tale if he doesn't pick it.
You've got to pick your best players. You've got to be heartless in this situation.
Well, unless you've guaranteed a player something.
Well...
Then I don't think...
I'm sorry, but even then...
Well, then you undermine yourself.
But listen, we've had this before with Sarri and sort of, you know, Sarri in my mind wanted to bring on... This wasn't Kepa an injury. This was a pre-organised idea in Sarri's mind, in my view, to bring on Caballero because he was a penalty specialist.
That was definitely what happened.
And sorry, but you've got to be brutal. You've got to be brutal about this. Wenger always used to pick his second choice goalkeeper for the Cups. And then sometimes I thought he would pick Ospina rather than Cech for a big game because he's given his word to Ospina. Ospina's a far inferior goalkeeper to Petr Cech. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. And so you're picking your second best. What message does that send? It's a real dilemma because everyone loves... You know, Gomez, what a great story. But Foster has been one of the best goalkeepers, bar none, this season in the Premier League. He's been absolutely terrific.
But the one thing at Watford, Ali, is that the business plan, you know, is written in blood. Mm. And essentially, Doucouré is probably going to be the next big money signing out of there. You know, that's the next sale. He could leave them by getting them to a final because he and Kapuè are probably... going to be the key figures in that team on Saturday, on Sunday.
Oh, yeah. No, I like John, I've been critical of Watford in the past as well. I've got a horrible feeling. I thought they might provide the first sacking of the season. How stupid was that? But they've got such a tradition of as soon as it wobbles, just, you know, guillotine, OK, we'll start again. There is... there's a lot that's impressive about Watford, but I think probably most people would say it's their midfield. You're absolutely right. And I think we forget how hard it is to find midfielders who have... They can pass, they're intuitive, they're hardworking, they can battle, they can time tackles well. So if you've got midfielders who can do those things, not just, and to know when to do it as well. So the impressive thing about Watford is 1-0 ahead. The management of the game is so good, and that comes from a very, very intelligent midfield. And they'll need all the intelligence they can get, because I think probably if you were to say, apart from, you know, teams beginning with W, which two teams have surprised you by their tactical intelligence this season, it would be Watford and Wolves, actually. And I love the way that Nuno sets up his teams depending on who they're playing, and they follow his instructions to the letter. If he says, we're going to bore the life out of everyone for 75 minutes, that's what they will do. They're just so good at, again, managing the teams, which could lead to a game that is horribly sterile, or it could just implode and we just see some fantastic football. I've no idea which way it'll go. But it will be, you're absolutely right, for on both sides, it's about midfield intelligence and patience.
I've done pieces with... a couple of Wolves players this season, you know, Colo Coli and Moutinho, and they're both obviously varying ends of the scales, but being at really, really top clubs. And the way that they buy into Nuno and his coaching and his vision, his messages, the philosophy, the way that they play, his vision is just, you know, as you rightly say, Arsene, he's, you know, he's got them absolutely believing they will do, they will run through brick walls for this guy. I mean, you know, Conor Coady says without doubt he's by far and away the best manager that he's come across, and his vision and the way that he gets them playing is great. He's been able to attract, because it goes beyond just kind of the accusation, oh, they're just, you know, the buy-in through an agent that basically get those players. The players that are of a calibre that want to play for this guy, they believe in his system, they believe in his style. But he's gone also beyond that, because he's held on to the players that were already there. He's developed the likes of a Matt Doherty, for example, who earlier in the season, for my mind, was fantastic. For all the teams that play with wing-backs, he was right up there, I thought. I think Patricio is arguably one of the best keepers in the league. You know, they've got fantastic midfield talent. You know, Jimenez has been terrific. They really are a very, very exciting team. For us to be talking about them in such glowing terms, I know they had a bad result at Burnley, but they still play well. In the first season up is a remarkable leap. And, that, you know, it wasn't ridiculous overall wholesale changes. He's bled the new players in gradually. And that is a fabulous achievement. If they can reach an FA Cup final in the back of the season, it'd be really, really impressive.
But it's fascinating. What do you think Nuno will do? Because I think we can predict in most matches how Wolves will set up. So if they're playing a top six team, especially if they're playing them away from home, they do this very cautious waiting game and then they pounce. They struggled against teams that are bottom half of the table and are themselves negative. But how will Nuno assess the challenge? Because Watford are neither a really big team, they're nowhere near being a poor team, and they're on neutral territory, and both teams have nothing else to play for. Both teams really need this. It's not going to impinge on anything else they do. They really want to get to the final. So I'm intrigued as to whether Nuno tells his players they're the underdogs, or whether I'm struggling to know how he'll psychologically approach it.
Moutinho's view on it was that basically against the bigger teams, you probably get a little bit more time on the ball because you're playing sort of more quality opposition, whereas against the lesser teams, it's almost a bit more frenetic. And I can understand that, because Wolves' results against the top six, I mean, fantastic. Mm. And even in games where They're basically drop points against Chelsea. Well, they should have won against Chelsea, shouldn't they?
I mean, it's. But do they treat Watford like a top six club?
Well,
I think it's a top six occasion.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think that's the difference.
Yeah. But I think that Watford will be more standoffish. Mm. So I think then that basically the way that Watford set up, I think it was almost like two counter-attacking teams set up against each other, really. It will be interesting.
You know, you mentioned there, John, about, you know, a group of players buying into a coach or a manager. You know, the narrative is that all the Man United players are bought into Ollie, who's at the wheel, apparently, whatever that means. You look at that squad, it will be rebuilt by the sheer weight of money and corporate ambition. But will they lose any players? Now, I'm thinking of Pogba here, Paul Pogba. You know, there's this little courtship dance already started by Zidane at Madrid. Will Pogba eventually think to himself, I can expand my brand in Madrid?
Well, he will expand his brand if he goes to Madrid. There's no doubt about it. And I don't... The key to it all is whether... It doesn't matter what happens with Pogba, whether he stays or goes. What matters is how it's portrayed and how Solskjaer is seen to have handled it. Because it should emerge, whatever happens, it should look like it's what Solskjaer wanted or encouraged to happen. So Solskjaer is going to face an early test of his demeanour as a manager, his status, if he was to, and I don't think he would do anything as stupid as this, but if he was to go public about, we under no circumstances will United lose a player of Pogba's stature. We are not intimidated by Real Madrid. We will not be held to ransom. we want Pogba to stay, and then Pogba left, then he'd look stupid. But he has to, Solskjaer has to navigate it cleverly, I think, and he has to decide how much of what Pogba says on social media is just that side of him, and whether he's got to know him properly as a player and can calculate that actually what he really wants is to stay at Man United and for us to try and win the league and for him to be an integral part of that and to make history at a club that helped shape him. So he has to... And I think Solskjaer, from what I can gather, does have that empathy and that ability to get to know young players and work out what they want. So it's, I don't think it matters if they lose Pogba, unless it's seen as they lost. In some way, it's a battle that they lost. If they did, if he did go to Real Madrid, they'd get a hell of a lot of dosh for him, and it would just have to be reinvested properly. I've never seen a match. Well, I've seen a couple, but I've only seen a couple of matches where I thought, oh, Man United couldn't have won that without Paul Pogba. He's not been the dominant force in the Premier League that he promised to be. So if they could make a profit on him and lose someone who's sometimes slightly embarrassing with what he says and distracting as well, then that would be absolutely fine. But equally, if they felt they knew the player well and he actually, despite the flirtations, wanted to make history with Manchester United and kept hold of him, that would be a great outcome also.
Mm. Do you expect quite a lot of business done there in the summer, John? You know, there's already... it looks like Aaron Wan-Bissaka at Palace is going to be one of their first targets. A lot of money spent, a lot of column inches devoted to it.
Yeah, I do, really. It's obvious, isn't it, that basically I think they'll have to look at right back. They've got a big issue there. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with Pogba. I think they need three top quality signings, basically. I mean, the right back, I think, is absolutely crucial. Wan-Bissaka is a lot of pressure on. I mean, obviously, I'm sure he's on their list, but I do think they'll have to look to really strengthen, because I think the gap still, even though Solskjaer has improved them dramatically, the gap between the top two and the rest in the Premier League, I think, will still take a lot of bridging, really. And that's not just for Man United, it's for Tottenham, it's for Chelsea, it's for Arsenal. There's the top two are really in danger, I think, of breaking away. And if I had to name one that could possibly push on next season and kind of push those top two, if they make the right investments this summer, then it is Manchester United. Because I do think that Solskjaer has inherited a squad with great potential. You know, I mean, without doubt, they've got the best goalkeeper in the world. He's got them defending better. He's got the best out of Luke Shaw. He's got a better midfield balance. But that midfield needs surgery, in my view, because, you know, I think Matic is a good player, and he's certainly playing much better under Solskjaer. But then he's got to have the right kind
Declan,
of...
That's a Declan Rice shape hole, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it will be really interesting, that, with Declan Rice, because he impressed so much on his England debut. All of a sudden, he's gone from being kind of making really the right moves with West Ham and looking really good for West Ham, and suddenly sort of saying, well, actually, he's probably got the ability at international level. Once you've got the ability at an international level, you can probably play in the Champions League. So you can bet your bottom dollar that basically a lot of clubs will now be looking at. I'll be ever so disappointed and surprised if basically he goes this summer. I think he'll probably stay for a little bit, yeah, sure.
Well, West Ham, you know, have almost issued a come and get him plea, haven't they? You know, he's obviously, if someone comes along with a shed load of money, they'll take it.
Yeah, probably, but I just think that with Rice, I think what's really great is that sort of, listen, West Ham had a bad result on the weekend, yeah, but I think they've made decent strides under Manuel Pellegrini, actually.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of, the midfield makeup and balance has been enhanced by Rice. But Rice is still a player who I think is riding that crest of the wave, and sometimes you do have a dip as a young player, and I'm sure that will come. But I just think that I think West Ham is still a good grounding for young players, and they give young players a good chance, as they've done with Rice. And they've developed him, and they've not been afraid to play him going from centre-half into midfield, and they've been creative with him. They've given him that platform. Yeah. I still think he might be there for a while, yeah.
West Ham are at Chelsea next Monday. Will Sarri be there?
Well, he probably will. I mean, they did win at the weekend. Let's not forget that. Honestly, it is interesting the way results are reinterpreted. You could say there was a club who rested their two most crucial players in Kante and Hazard, and therefore didn't quite click, and the opposition did better than expected, and there was booing from the Chelsea fans, and yet they had the resilience and the togetherness to summon a result. And that's supposed to make a manager look good and supported by his players, and to make him look like he's someone who's got some flexibility and an ability, you know, to keep players on side when times are difficult. But no, instead, most people are interpreting it as, well, it doesn't really matter what the result was. Chelsea still play very badly. Because what they mean is Chelsea are still playing Sarri ball. That's the problem. It's not about that result. It's about how he plays.
Chelsea have bred this, haven't they, themselves? Yeah. By this constant managerial change. And then basically also, the fact is that basically there's this feeling that if the Chelsea fans can't take to Sarri, then they'll have to get rid of Sarri. Well, good luck with that, because Chelsea fans won't take to Sarri. Well, unfortunately, this comes from a long history of not then supporting a manager through difficult times. Personally, I'm not completely convinced that Sarri is suited to Chelsea, and it's just one of those things that maybe might not fit. But I think they'll leave it till the summer, by which time Chelsea have this amazing opportunity to go and win the Europa League. Because because of the run of fixtures that Chelsea have got, Chelsea are well capable of winning that trophy. That would be a European trophy, a passport back into the Champions League, which at the moment looks very much up in the air for the top four places. They will probably lose Hazard. They will probably suffer this transfer window ban. And then they can make a change to a younger, perhaps more ambitious manager who can bring in some younger players. It might just be the shot in the arm that Chelsea need. But it doesn't. The negativity at the moment from the fans towards Sarri is just a bridge that's not going to be, I don't think...
It's overwhelming. And it did have, you know, I take your point about, you know, results can, you know, camouflage anything. But they were appalling in for 75% of that game. The fans were basically openly in rebellion from about 15 minutes onwards. Jorginho, who is his totemic figure in the team, was jeered when he was substituted. They've reached a point of no return, haven't they?
Under normal circumstances, but the owner isn't that bothered at the moment, and it doesn't make... In no way does it make sense to sack him tomorrow, for example. Because, as John says, they certainly look very likely to get to the Europa League final, and we don't know who they'd meet there. I've always felt it's always going to be Napoli v Chelsea in the Europa League final because the narrative's too compelling.
You're putting a great deal of faith in Arsenal, then.
No, only because.
Yeah.
It's just football too irresistible. It's like too irresistible. Yeah. The two.
Talking of irresistible things, I just want to end. We're coming to the end. Neil Warnock. You know, there was a fantastic double teapot yesterday, wasn't there? Were there also double standards?
Well, yeah, because I've got a few views on this, and I do quite like, I'll declare an interest, I do quite like Neil Warnock. I think he's a character in the game. But look, the thing is about that is that I wouldn't condone the way that we reacted. And also, bearing in mind, back in November, it was Cardiff who were the beneficiaries of a ridiculously but also incredibly similar 90th minute win.
Exactly.
From Solbamba, and it's just there. It's a 2-1 win, and basically Neil Warnock then, I don't remember these quotes particularly, but basically saying, "Oh, it's you know, I've had this luck coming. Basically, it's a bit of luck, and sort of, you know, my missus told me that it was going to happen in the tea leaves. My luck would change." So I just think though that that completely overlooks the fact that in a red rage of temper, Neil Warnock could possibly bring himself to remember that 4 months ago he was the lucky one, whereas Brighton and Chris Hughton, who acted with far more reservation and class, and basically had a moan at about the officials and the goal, and then put it to bed, but didn't go off the scale about that. But where I think I do have sympathy with Neil Warnock on this, and by the way, Neil Warnock will unquestionably get charged. It's obviously a no-brainer, and he has to, really, because you can't really act like that, is that the standard of officiating in the Premier League right now is at an all-time low. That decision yesterday was so bad. And yes, Neil Warnock behaved rather badly, but anyone that cannot understand when you think of what's at stake, and this is could be the biggest moment in his career by keeping Cardiff up, and Cardiff are a lower-end championship squad. They really are. And for him to even be in with a shout of keeping them up is a remarkable achievement. I'm sorry, anyone that can't understand his anger at that point, you're not getting the passion of the game. Am I excusing it? No, but I'm just trying to explain it, basically. But the standard of officials, Mike, is a shocker.
No, I take that point.
Absolutely unbelievable. And people will talk about VAR, but we're also expecting the same group of officials to implement the VAR. So will VAR be solved as soon as VAR... will these decisions be solved? I'm not completely convinced, because the reason why that VAR on occasion, when we've experimented with it, has been a dog's dinner and been an absolute disaster, is because we have pretty poor officials trying to use VAR. The standard's at an all-time low. It's a crisis of refereeing. It really is. We've got two or three good ones, but the rest, come on, should be nowhere near it.
Cardiff, they've got their own problems. It looks like probably relegation could be decided by a game at Burnley in a couple of weeks. But I just want to look a little bit higher to finish. Just a very quick response, please. We started talking about Manchester City and the quadruple. How many trophies will they win? Ali?
Two, and they've already won one. They'll win the FA Cup.
John?
Ooh, who's going to win the Champions League then?
Probably Liverpool or Barcelona.
OK, I think they'll win three.
They'll miss out on?
I think they might miss out on the Premier League.
Funny that, I think they'll end up with three as well. Destiny calls for Liverpool. They'll win the league. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.